From WRKF in Baton Rouge and WWNO in New Orleans, you're listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Karen Henderson. On the show today, new research shows Black pregnant women continue to die at much higher rates than white pregnant women in the state. And later, a new exhibition combines astronomy with quilting. But first, Louisiana has a school attendance problem. Over 50,000 students in the Baton Rouge area had more than five unexcused absences last year. That's according to the latest research from the Baton Rouge Area Chamber. The organization looked at attendance rates and the broader ripple effects they have on the community. We're joined now by Jake Polansky, the Chamber's Manager of Economic and Policy Research. Jake, thanks for being here.
Hey, Karen.
Jake, what do we currently know about the rate of absenteeism in area schools? How many kids are showing up later or not showing up at all?
Sure. So chronic absenteeism has gotten really bad across the country. Pretty much everywhere you look, more students are chronically absent today than they were prior to COVID. And that's extremely true right here in the Capital Region. So to put some numbers on that, last school year, there were about 125,000 public school students across the Capital Region, and about 26,300 of those were considered chronically absent. So that's about one in five students last year that were considered chronically absent.
All righty. Well, tell us about your research. What did you set out to find, and how did you go about it?
Yeah, so chronic absenteeism, it's gained a lot of attention across the country. It really has. So we looked into certain solutions, and some of those solutions that we looked at are pretty costly, and a lot of them can be temporary. For example, the state of Connecticut is using COVID money to stand up a home visit program where employees of the school district go visit the homes of students that are chronically absent and try to encourage them to come back to school, try to understand why they're not attending school. And we've seen programs like this and other similar programs across the country. But the unfortunate thing about these programs is that while they're effective, they are really expensive to maintain. And without that COVID-enhanced funding, it's unlikely that these programs can continue for the long term. Delaying school start times, on the other hand, while there are certain concerns and certain costs associated with it, they have been shown through research to really address chronic absenteeism as well as a lot of other issues. They would help address student performance. Delaying school start times has been shown to improve academic performance in our students. It's also been linked to enhanced economic growth because of kind of a domino effect that you see when students are back into school. They're more likely to actually keep up with the material, which leads them to be more likely to graduate. So there's that domino effect that you see there. So delaying school start times is a solution not only for chronic absenteeism, but also for a lot of other issues facing our students and our schools.
Jake, you mentioned action taken by other states. What are some others doing that Louisiana might want to imitate, even beyond delaying the start of school?
Sure. So two states have actually very recently passed legislation to delay school start times, and those states are California and Florida. So this is by no means a political issue in any way. These are two very different states that we're talking about. And the legislation in those states looks exactly like the proposed legislation in this state. In both of those states, they pass laws that say that middle schools cannot start before 8 in the morning, high schools cannot start before 8:30 in the morning. And those are the two states that have successfully passed legislation, but this issue is gaining a lot of attention across the country right now. So in a few states, there's legislation pending to study the issue, to form a task force or a committee to study what the impact in their state would be. Those states look like Indiana, they look like New Mexico, a couple others are Maryland and New Jersey. And those last two states are interesting because Maryland and New Jersey, they passed legislation a few years ago to study it. And after they studied it, now there's actually current pending legislation to actually push back school start times, because whatever the study found, they obviously found some productive benefits that students and schools would see. So Maryland and New Jersey currently have pending legislation to push back school start times. Other states look like Maine and New York and Connecticut. So these are some states that already have pretty high performing school districts. And this shows that what we're proposing in this state is something that states that are on the forefront of K-12 education are also currently looking at and currently doing.
We're talking with BRAC Manager of Economic and Policy Research, Jake Polansky, about recent findings on chronic absenteeism in the Capital Region. You mentioned legislation here in Louisiana. What do you think about it's House Bill 725 that would require middle schools to start no earlier than 8 a.m., high schools no earlier than 8:30 a.m.?
Sure. So House Bill 725 does propose that middle schools start no earlier than 8 and high schools no earlier than 8:30. And this is one of the four bills that BRAC is publicly supporting this year, because the research has shown that pushing back school start times comes with significant benefits, a lot of the benefits that we've already talked about. Not only does it improve academic performance, not only does it improve attendance, not only does it reduce juvenile crime, there's a lot of significant benefits that pushing back school start times could do for the Capital Region. And one good thing about this bill is that it affords school leaders and administrators two full academic years before the proposed legislation would take effect in the 2026-2027 school year. So we've heard some concerns around pushing back school start times. We've heard concerns around what new bus schedules would look like and if there's an associated price tag. And for high school specifically, we've heard a lot about, you know, extracurriculars. If schools start later, that means they're going to end later. So how are high schoolers still going to have time for sports, for band, and other extracurriculars? But we hope that when the benefits are weighed against some of these concerns that have been raised, which are very valid concerns, we hope that legislators and those who are tracking this legislation see these benefits and understand that we could do a lot for our students just by delaying school start times.
Jake, do you have any sense of legislative support? What are you hearing? And what are parents saying? What are students saying about delaying the start of school?
Sure. So we have heard some legislative support for this. We're hoping for more. We've heard from parents that are excited about this because they understand that their students need more sleep. And this is a great way to make sure that their students are getting more sleep. And we have heard some concerns, you know, some concerns raised around transportation issues. What would the new bus schedules look like? And would there be an associated cost for that? For high schoolers specifically, we've heard some concerns around, you know, after school activities. If schools are starting later, that means they're ending later. So how is this going to impact after school activities like band, like sports, other extracurriculars? And there are other school districts, for example, Jefferson Parish outside of New Orleans, that has pushed back school start times. I believe their high school start at 8:15 in the morning now. And this was a move that they did after COVID, I believe, to save costs. And they've turned out just fine. They still have after-school activities. They still have sports that are competitive. So we hope that when some of these concerns are kind of weighed against these benefits that we talked about, benefits like improved academic performance, improved attendance, we hope that these benefits really are seen by parents and anybody else who may be concerned about these changes.
Jake Polansky, Manager of Economic and Policy Research for the Baton Rouge Area Chamber. Thanks, Jake.
Thank you, Karen.
WRKF in Baton Rouge and WWNO in New Orleans, you're listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Karen Henderson. A new report from the Louisiana Department of Health shows Black pregnant women continue to die at much higher rates than white pregnant women in the state. The report covers maternal deaths in 2020. It found Black women are 2.5 times more likely to die than their white counterparts. Reporter Rosemary Westwood spoke with Dr. Veronica Gillespie. She's an OBGYN who leads the health department's efforts to improve maternal health, and she's one of the report's authors.
Dr. Gillespie Bell, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So this report found continued and pretty dramatic racial disparities in maternal deaths in Louisiana. I'm wondering what struck you, because this is I think the third or fourth report you've done for the state into maternal deaths.
Yes, I think there were a few things that struck me. First of all, the continued contribution of accidental overdose to the number of deaths. As we look at the report for this year, we see a large number of accidental overdose for pregnancy associated but not related deaths, but even for pregnancy related deaths. And so just as a reminder, a pregnancy related death is the death of an individual at the time of pregnancy up to 1 year of the end of pregnancy from a condition that is related to the pregnancy. And so for those accidental overdose cases, the committee, when reviewing, saw something in the medical record or in the records that we reviewed that showed that pregnancy exacerbated or started substance use disorder, and that contributed to those deaths. And so that was not surprising, I guess is not the right word, but disheartening to see. We know that substance use disorder is increasing across the United States, and Louisiana is not left out of that, and that use is increasing in the general population, and our pregnant patients, unfortunately, are not absolved, and so we're seeing that play out in the data. And then, as you mentioned, when we look at our pregnancy-related deaths, 13 of the 15 deaths were among Black women, and so that also is very, very hard to look at and see, especially as a Black woman, and looking at those causes, cardiovascular conditions, cardiomyopathy, we do know that Black women are disproportionately impacted by those conditions. And so it really speaks to the need of being able to address and optimize those medical conditions before pregnancy, as well as after pregnancy, because every individual is either ending a pregnancy, getting ready for another pregnancy. And so making sure that we are getting those medical conditions optimized for pregnancy.
I want to ask one more note about that larger picture of deaths among people who've been pregnant up to a year after that. And homicides is a high, is a leading cause of death in those cases as well. That isn't new, is it?
You're correct. That is not new. As a matter of fact, we've had homicide as one of our leading causes of pregnancy associated but not related for several years. And a couple of years ago, myself and a researcher, Dr. Maeve Wallace at Tulane, we asked the question, are homicides increasing in the general population? And is that why we're seeing that number increase in our pregnant population? So we looked at the data across the United States between 2016 and 2018, I believe were the years that we used. And we found that the rate of homicide amongst pregnant individuals was increasing at a rate higher than that among women in general that were not pregnant in that same age group.
You know, I think one of the most striking parts of the report, and this has been true for previous reports that you've done with the Department of Health, is that, you know, most, and when I say most, like 80, 90% of these deaths are deemed possibly preventable. They didn't need to happen. Can you explain that? What does that mean?
Yes. Thank you for the opportunity to explain that, because I do think that becomes a bit confusing about what we mean by preventability. So preventability, as it is defined by the CDC, is what we use. And it means if there was any chance at all that we could have done any one thing differently, could that death have been prevented? And that means if there was a good chance that we could have changed the outcomes, or if there was just some chance. With those areas of preventability, that's where we develop our recommendations, because then that means that there's something that we could have done differently.
And what are those recommendations, and have they changed this year compared to previous reports?
So great question. Some of the recommendations have changed. Our general priorities have been about the same, making sure that we are addressing racial and cultural bias. Again, when we see our disparities and we see the persistence of the disparities, we still need to address racial and cultural bias. We have identifying and addressing social determinants of health. We know that 80% of clinical outcomes are due to social drivers. And so we have to address those if we're going to improve these clinical outcomes. So that's not new. We have to improve screening for substance use disorder, for perinatal mood and anxiety disorders, intimate partner violence, social determinants of health. That's not a new recommendation. I think this is newer. We've said it, but not so prominently before. But we have to improve patient and family-centered care, including education on the warning signs and individual risk for maternal morbidity and mortality. This is not about putting all of the onus on the patient. We can't expect our patients to always understand the warning signs or be able to respond. And so we as healthcare systems and healthcare providers have to do a better job about educating also the family members of what those post-birth warning signs are so that we know when to bring patients back into care. Some of the other recommendations that we have consistently recommended: improving care coordination before, during, and after pregnancy, improving the treatment of substance use disorder so that we are treating according to evidence-based guidelines, that we are offering medication-assisted therapy for those patients who do experience opioid use disorder during pregnancy, and then just overall increasing and improving harm reduction strategies.
Dr. Veronica Glispie-Bell is one of the authors of Louisiana's new report from the Department of Health looking at pregnancy-associated deaths among people in 2020. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
From WRKF in Baton Rouge and WWNO in New Orleans, you're listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Karen Henderson. The LSU Museum of Art will host a unique exhibition of quilts inspired by planetary science. The fiber artwork exhibition, Fierce Planets, Word from the Studio Art Quilt Associates, draws from the research of renowned planetary physicist Dr. Sabina Stanley and her book, What's Hidden Inside Planets. The exhibition is curated by Michelle Schulte. Dr. Stanley and Ms. Schulte are our guests today. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Dr. Stanley, first, I know listeners can probably picture a quilt, but can you describe what a quilt inspired by planetary science looks like?
Oh, there are so many answers to this. And I have to say that this entire show has revolutionized my understanding of the quilt, right? What this has really been about is taking the materials and the processes that you might associate with quilting, but really make it a piece of art as associated with planets in some way related to the book, right? So you've got everything from depictions of what people think might be at the center of planets to illustrations based on NASA images of Jupiter's winds and so forth. So it's actually really quite spectacular.
Well, Dr. Stanley, the name of the exhibition is Fierce Planets. Is the word fierce an accurate response to describe what you've discovered about planets in your research?
Absolutely. One of the things I love about talking about the interiors of planets is when I start talking about the fact that the temperatures inside planets are thousands of degrees and the pressure is millions of atmospheres. This is an environment that we just do not experience on the surface of the Earth. And so you can imagine what happens when you've got rock that's thousands of degrees and under extreme pressures. We get new phases of matter we've never experienced on the surface of the Earth. You can get helium rain. You can get diamond icebergs at the center of, for example, Neptune. You can get iron snow inside Mercury. So it really is quite fierce when you think of the conditions.
What do you think about this collaboration between art and science? I mean, it's really unusual.
Frankly, it's a dream come true for me. I'll be honest about this. I've always been inspired by art, and I really think that art and science are natural partners with very similar ways of doing work, right? When you think of the artist and the processes that artists use, it's very technical, very, very deep thinking. You get lost in the work. You work sort of at the cutting edge of stuff. same sort of stuff happens in science. And so I feel a kinship.
We're talking with planetary physicist Dr. Sabina Stanley and LSU Museum of Art curator Michelle Schulte about an exhibition that features quilts inspired by the insides of planets. Now, Michelle, I understand the exhibition also features some objects and artifacts from LSU's Department of Physics and Astronomy. What are some of those items and why were they included?
Yeah. So it's really interesting. I was approached by a gentleman named Will Recker, and he was from the Studio Art Quilt Associates. He's sort of the exhibition manager to do this show. And he let me pick from a panel of things or a menu of shows that we could have done. And I immediately was drawn to this one because LSU has such a strong connection with NASA as well. We have a lot of NASA grants and a lot of NASA research that's going on through the Michaud assembly facility that's outside of New Orleans. And so I thought, well, this is perfect. This is a great way for me to go over onto campus, onto LSU, and collaborate with individuals outside the College of Art and Design. I love the College of Art and Design, but the college is huge. I really wanted to explore other departments in the university. And so I met Dr. Jeffrey Blackman. He's the chair of the Department of Physics. And then Dr. Daryl Henry, he's from geophysics. And between the three of us, we gathered a team together to determine all kinds of different objects we could integrate into the exhibition and also what we could do in terms of programming. And so we will have everything from slices of meteorite, different individual geological artifacts that represent different parts of the Earth, you know, from the crust going down, things that they've pulled up through core drilling. And so we'll have those on display along with some interpretation that's easy to understand. And then something that I'm really excited about, we have a tile from the space shuttle that LSU has in their possession. So that will be on view. Plus, we're able to do some really interesting programming. They have an inflatable planetarium. And so they're going to bring it over into the gallery where the quilts are. And we'll have a full day where kids and adults can come and do a planetarium show at an art museum.
Man, that sounds great.
It's really exciting.
Well, yeah. I know the opening is this Thursday, April 18th. What's planned?
So we're combining this with another exhibition that also has to do with space. We have a selection of photographs by Roland Miller and astronaut Paolo Nespoli. Paolo Nespoli, he was on the International Space Station several times. And Roland Miller, who was here on the ground, partnered with Paolo to do these incredibly detailed images of the inside of the International Space Station. And so those are on view in an adjoining gallery. So we're combining the two exhibitions because they're space themed. And so we will have Dr. Stanley and Roland Miller on a panel being interviewed by an astrophysicist named Natalie Minkle from LSU. And so it should be really fun.
Planetary physicist Dr. Sabina Stanley and LSU Museum of Art curator Michelle Schulte. The exhibition Fierce Planets, Word from the Studio Art Quilt Associates, opens this Thursday, April 18th. It runs through July 28th at the LSU Museum of Art. Dr. Stanley, Michelle, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From WRKF in Baton Rouge and WWNO in New Orleans, you've been listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Karen Henderson. Thanks to our guests, Manager of Economic and Policy Research for the Baton Rouge Area Chamber, Jake Polanski, and Rosemary Westwood, Reproductive Health Reporter for WWNO and WRKF. Also thanks to Dr. Sabina Stanley and Curator at the LSU Museum of Art, Michelle Schulte. Our Managing Producer is Alana Schreiber. Our contributing producers are Matt Bloom and Adam Voss. We receive production and technical support from Garrett Pittman, and our assistant producer is Aubrey Purcell. You can listen to Louisiana Considered Monday through Friday at noon and 7 p.m. on this station. It's available on Spotify, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Major support for Louisiana Considered provided by Rouse's Markets, a Louisiana shopping experience, with additional support from the Historic New Orleans Collection.